I want you to just pull out your phone right now, if you can, and just scroll back in your camera roll to your last big trip. Just take a mental glance at it.
Yeah, let's be real. It's probably overwhelming.
Right. It is. You are likely staring at this massive digital graveyard of just thousands of image files.
Yeah.
You've got the cobblestone streets, the, sunset over the water, the obligatory plates of food.
Oh, always the food photos.
Always. And of course, those quick, rigid portraits you take standing awkwardly in front of monuments.
Yeah, the classic tourist staff.
Exactly. But I mean, if you are brutally honest with yourself about those photos, the vast majority of them are just kind of dead in the cloud.
Dead in the cloud. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
They just act as this sterile timestamp proof that you were, physically present in the location. But they completely fail to capture how it actually felt to be there in that specific moment.
It's so true. I mean, we really find ourselves in this bizarre modern dilemma where we have never documented our lives more obsessively, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But we end up with these massive high-definition archives that just feel emotionally hollow. We use this incredibly advanced technology to capture, the exact way optical light bounces off an object.
Right, in perfect 4K resolution.
Exactly. But in the process of hoarding all that visual data, we somehow completely miss the actual human experience of the moment.
And that massive gap between a sterile vacation photo and a profound living memory, that is exactly what we are exploring in our deep dive today.
It's such a fascinating topic.
It really is. We are looking at what it actually takes to transform a static, forgettable digital file into a powerful narrative about human connection. And to do this, we're looking at a really fascinating case study today.
Yeah, we're focusing on a digital artwork.
Right. It's titled Clemencia in Venezia, created by the visual artist Jaro Duque.
And the source material we have for this piece is just unusually rich.
It really is. We have so much to work with.
Yeah, because we aren't just analyzing the finished digital canvas here. We actually have access to the official gallery document.
Which is huge.
It is. And they happen to include this deeply reflective, incredibly raw essay written by the artist himself.
Like a peek behind the curtain.
Exactly. He actually deconstructs his own creative process, his philosophical intentions, and even his perceived technical failures, like in real time.
Wow.
Yeah, getting this level of unfiltered access to an artist's internal monologue while they're, still working through their medium is incredibly rare in the art world.
Okay, let's unpack this because this artwork manages to bridge two completely opposite extremes, right?
Oh, for sure.
On one side, you have the heavy, monumental, centuries-old history of an ancient city, and on the other, the very intimate, fleeting reality of human relationship.
It's a massive contrast.
Huge. And to understand how Duke builds that bridge, we have to look at the tools he chose to build it with.
Yeah, the technical side is crucial here.
Right. So the gallery notes start with these seemingly dry technical specs, but they're actually a massive key to the whole philosophy of the piece. Like, this is a 9 by 12 inch digital artwork
9 by 12, yeah.
created on an iPad using a program called Procreate, and it was born directly from a personal family photograph.
And that completely subverts the traditional kind of romanticized image we hold of the, solitary genius artist at
And
work.
totally, the guy in the messy studio.
Right. When we think of a masterpiece, we tend to picture someone wrestling with the physical constraints of the world. We imagine the weight of stretching a massive canvas, the unpredictable texture of the material.
The fumes of the turpentine.
Exactly, the fumes of the studio and the literal race against the clock before oil paints dry and, lock a decision in place forever.
Yeah, the digital workflow completely shatters those physical limitations.
It really does.
I mean, working on a tablet means you are quite literally painting with light. The screen provides this immediate backlit luminosity that you simply cannot get from pigment reflecting ambient light in a standard room.
Right. The medium itself is fundamentally different.
And the biggest shift has to be the freedom of the infinite undo and redo. You aren't committed to a brushstroke the second it hits the canvas.
Which is a game changer.
It is. You can experiment wildly, duplicate entire layers, try out 100 different color combinations without ever destroying the underlying foundation of the portrait.
And this technological shift, it allows for a kind of hypermobility that traditional mediums simply cannot match. It fundamentally alters the lifespan and the journey of the art itself.
How so?
Well, if we track the geographical footprint of Clemencia in Venezia, It maps out this staggering story about transcending physical
Oh,
borders.
right, because of where it was made.
Exactly. The piece was created in July of 2023, but the artist was nowhere near Italy at the
Yeah,
time.
he was in California, right?
Right. It was made in a quiet, isolated studio in Whittier, California.
Wait, I have to jump in here for a second.
Okay.
Because if he is just tapping a piece of glass in a quiet room in Southern California, entirely removed from the physical location he's actually depicting, doesn't that sort of strip away the soul of the work?
That's a very common question, yeah. Like, there is no texture, no physical struggle with the elements, no breathing the air of the city he's painting. It feels a bit, I don't know, clinical.
I get why you'd say that.
Because we are so conditioned to believe that the physical permanence and the, manual labor of a traditional oil painting are what give it historical weight. So does this lack of physical friction make digital art somehow less meaningful?
Well, that is probably the most common critique leveled at the digital art world, right? This assumption that a lack of physical material automatically equates to a lack of soul.
Exactly.
Yeah. But what we see in the sources, particularly in the artist's own reflections, is that the friction hasn't actually disappeared. It's just relocated.
Relocated. What do you mean?
Because the artist isn't fighting the logistics of stretching a 3-meter canvas or mixing toxic chemicals or, arranging for complex international shipping crates to move his work.
He has all this extra energy.
Exactly. He has a massive surplus of energy. The friction has moved entirely from the physical material to the conceptual idea on the screen. Okay, I see. So he's pouring all of that saved logistical energy into solving the narrative conflict of the painting itself.
Exactly. The technology isn't sterilizing the art, it's actually accelerating it. Like, think about the physical journey of this specific file.
Right, from California.
Yeah, from that very localized origin point in a California studio, the artwork just seamlessly crossed the Atlantic Ocean to be exhibited at the Art Books and Indian Art Gallery in Athens, Greece.
In late 2023, yeah.
Right. And then after that European exhibition, it crossed the world again, finally landing in its current home in the private collection of the Almanza Caicedo family in Cali, Colombia.
Wow, so California to Greece to Colombia.
Yes. The digital nature of the work allowed a deeply personal memory, which was forged in California, to connect continents and cultures almost simultaneously without ever suffering physical degradation.
That makes the studio in Whittier feel less like a traditional workshop and more like a, I don't know, a command center for memory processing.
Oh, that's a great way to describe it.
Which brings us to the actual visual strategy Duke employed on that 12-inch screen. Because when you look at the piece, it becomes obvious very quickly that he didn't just open Procreate to paint a mathematically perfect, high-resolution architectural rendering of Italy.
No, not at all.
He actually splits the canvas into two violently clashing aesthetic universes.
Yeah, the contrast is striking, and it is incredibly deliberate. He uses the digital tools to separate the environment from the subject entirely.
Yeah, tell me about the background.
So the background, which is the city of Venice itself, is rendered in this heavily desaturated, almost monochromatic palette.
It looks kind of ghostly.
Ghostly is the perfect word. The water, the bridges, the historic architecture, they're all executed with these very loose atmospheric brushstrokes. It is not a literal depiction of the city.
Right.
It's an abstraction, basically acting as a visual stand-in for the concept of collective memory.
And then by washing out the city like that, he creates this massive aesthetic vacuum. And, nature abhors a vacuum.
Oh, absolutely.
So he forces the viewer's eye to snap violently to the only thing left alive on the canvas, which is the subject in the foreground, Clemencia.
Right.
In total opposition to that ghostly background, she is rendered with absolute crispness. She's highly saturated, birthing with warm tones and lush greens, and she just completely dominates that diluted, fading background.
And the digital layer system in a program like Procreate is what facilitates this so perfectly.
Because he can keep them separate.
Exactly. He can isolate her completely, adjusting her saturation, her warmth, and her sharpness without ever bleeding into the desaturated background.
That's a huge advantage over traditional painting.
Huge. He is manually calculating the emotional depth of the scene, making a conscious, really forceful choice about what deserves our visual focus.
But, I mean, let me play devil's advocate for a second. Washing out an entire historic city just to make one person pop feels incredibly narcissistic, doesn't it?
Ah, well, it is a bold choice.
Like, you are taking centuries of architectural history, a place of unique light and vibrant reflections on the water that famous painters have obsessed over for hundreds of years, and you're just using it as a cheap green screen for a family photo.
Oh, I see where you're coming from. But if we connect this to the bigger picture laid out in the artist's essay, that perceived narcissism is actually the core conceptual strategy of the entire piece.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He refers to this as a deliberate hijack of the urban myth.
A hijack of the urban myth. Man, that is a brilliant way to frame it.
It really is, because think about it. The historical weight of Venice is crushing. If you render Venice in its full, brilliant, resplendent glory.
With the sparkling blue water and everything.
Yeah, with the perfect terracotta bricks and the majestic gondolas, the city inevitably devours the human subject.
Right, because it's too distracting.
Exactly. The background becomes so loud and demanding that the person in the foreground is reduced to a mere prop. They become just another, you know, anonymous tourist blocking the view of a beautiful monument.
Oh, wow. So by intentionally draining the life, the color, and the hard lines out of the Eternal City, the artist is forcing the monument to subordinate to the person.
Yes.
He is basically taking this world-famous location hostage and forcing it to serve his personal narrative rather than bowing down to the location's history.
Which is a profound reversal of how we normally interact with these colossal historic spaces.
We usually feel so tiny.
Right. We usually feel very small when we stand in front of something that has survived for centuries. But here, the artist is using his digital tools to shrink the ancient world down, making it just a quiet backdrop for something he deems far more important.
And that naturally brings us to the subject herself. I mean, who is Clemencia, and why does an entire ancient city need to be visually silenced just to highlight her?
Well, the essay reveals that this piece is fundamentally a profound act of gratitude.
Gratitude.
Yes. Clemencia is a pivotal figure in the artist's family history. So the artwork isn't just a casual portrait, you know. It is a monument to her specific importance in his life.
That raises a really important question about the nature of scale in art, then.
How so?
Well, if the whole point is intimacy and gratitude toward this specific family member, and Venice is just going to be a desaturated, blurry afterthought, to highlight that gratitude, why complicate the narrative by setting the painting in Europe at all?
Ah, I see what you mean.
Like, if the focus is purely on her, why not just paint a cozy, incredibly detailed, intimate portrait of Clemencia sitting in a comfortable chair in that Whittier studio where he was actually working?
That's a great point. But if he had painted her in the California studio, the piece would be beautiful and it would be intimate, but it would be hermetic.
Hermetic, like closed off.
Exactly. It would be closed off to the rest of the world. Venice wasn't chosen randomly here.
Yeah.
It was chosen specifically for its monumental legacy.
Right, the history.
Yeah, this is the historical crossroads of ancient commerce, of empires, of colossal artistic achievement. I mean, millions of people have walked those stones for centuries.
It essentially represents the pinnacle of human architectural and cultural achievement.
Exactly. So by taking a deeply personal, familiar family figure and placing her against centuries of history and surviving palaces, the artist does something incredible. He humanizes the unattainable.
That's powerful.
It is. He requires the grand, imposing scale of Venice to properly measure the immense scale of his gratitude for her. He is saying, essentially, that all of this history pales in comparison to what this person means to my family.
You know, you can actually see that dynamic in how she is physically positioned in the frame, too. The gallery notes point out a very specific detail that completely changes the psychological vibe of the piece.
Yeah, her posture.
Right. Clemencia isn't just passively sitting in a gondola, staring off into the distance, taking in the sights like a typical tourist who is overwhelmed by the location.
No, she's very engaged.
She has this open, radiant smile. She is breaking the fourth wall, looking directly out at the viewer, and she is just vibrating with life. She isn't observing the monument. It's like she has become the monument.
And what's fascinating here is how that specific detail, her smile, her direct engagement with the lens or the viewer, it creates what the artist describes as a tectonic collision between two distinct journeys.
Two journeys.
Yeah. On one hand, you have the exterior journey. This is the physical movement through the world. It's the act of tourism, exploring geography, crossing oceans, and, you know, walking over the ancient bridges of Venice.
The actual physical reality of moving our bodies through these famous spaces.
Exactly. But overlapping that is the interior journey.
Okay.
And this is the invisible realm of affection, of human connection, of family history, and deep-seated gratitude. The true art of this digital piece doesn't happen in the blurry background, and it doesn't happen in the saturated foreground.
Well, where does it happen?
It happens in the exact millisecond that those two journeys violently collide on the canvas. The physical location simply acts as a container for an emotional truth.
Which brings us to the gallery essay itself, which honestly might be the most surprising part of this entire deep dive.
It is incredibly unique.
Because normally when you walk into an art gallery and read the placard next to a painting, the text is heavily polished.
Oh, heavily edited.
It's usually designed to completely bulletproof the artwork against any criticism. It presents the artist as this unquestionable, fully formed genius who just perfectly executed a flawless vision without a single moment of doubt.
Yeah, typical art world PR.
But Jared Dugan doesn't play that game at all. He actively dissects his own methods in his essay, and he openly admits to having shifting technical goals and areas where he wants to improve.
And it completely strips away all the pretension of the traditional gallery space.
Yes.
Instead of a defensive wall of art speak, he invites the viewer directly into the messy, vulnerable reality of his own creative process.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because it feels exactly like listening to a movie director's audio commentary on a film they made a few years ago. You know?
Oh, that's a perfect comparison.
Where they are just eagerly pointing out the flaws in their own framing or pacing that the audience might not have even noticed.
And in that self-critique, Duke is pointing out a very specific tension in his digital process.
What does he say?
He explicitly states that as he looks forward to his future works, he wants to explore smoother, more subtle technical transitions.
Okay.
He acknowledges that the hard, aggressive contrast between the monochromatic, ghostly background of Venice and the highly saturated, hyper-sharp foreground of Clemencia is quite abrupt.
It is very stark.
It is. Mm-hmm. And he has a desire to master a more organic, seamless blending of those two clashing aesthetic universes.
But, and I think this is key, even while he critiques his own technical execution, he draws a very firm, uncompromising line in the sand regarding his priorities as an artist.
Oh, a huge line.
He states that he will never, under any circumstances, sacrifice the emotional narrative of the piece just to achieve a prettier, more academically perfect color transition.
Yeah, he identifies that emotional core as the human footprint.
The human footprint.
Yes. For Duke, that footprint is his ultimate mission. He recognizes that the digital tools at his disposal, the infinite layers, the perfect blending brushes, the color correction algorithms.
All the tech.
All of it. It could easily allow him to create a technically flawless painting.
He could make it look like a photograph.
Exactly. He could create the most magnificent, smooth gradients and perfectly balanced lighting. But if that technical perfection buries the raw emotion, if it lacks that human footprint, the resulting image is nothing more than an empty postcard. It has no soul.
It proves that his workspace in Whittier isn't just a factory pumping out definitive, finished consumer products for galleries in Greece or collectors in Colombia.
No, it's a laboratory.
Right. It is a continuous testing laboratory. He's using this incredibly powerful digital medium with all its hypermobility and lack of physical constraints, not to seek technical perfection, but to seek emotional accuracy.
That's a great way to put it.
He is prioritizing long-term emotional resonance over immediate technical polish.
And that vulnerability is the exact mechanism that makes the piece so successful.
How so?
Because by admitting that he is still experimenting, still trying to find the perfect visual balance between the heavy environment and the intimate subject, he aligns his process with the very nature of memory itself.
Oh, I see.
Memory is never a flawless, objective rendering of the past. It's messy. It is biased, and it is constantly being edited, rewritten, and desaturated by our current emotional state.
Let's take a step back and just look at the massive scope of what we've unpacked here today.
It's a lot.
The journey of Clemencia in Venezia is staggering when you view it from a bird's eye perspective. It starts in the quiet isolation of a California studio, built entirely out of pixels and light on a 12-inch iPad screen.
Yep.
It takes the infinite, crushing, monumental history of Venice and completely hijacks it, draining its color and blurring its lines to elevate a single intimate moment of gratitude toward a family member.
It's beautiful.
And then, without a single drop of physical paint or the friction of a wooden shipping crate, it travels across the world to a gallery in Greece and finally to a family collection in Colombia. It is literally editing the physical world to protect and highlight what the artist truly loves. So what does this all mean for us?
Well, I think it leads to a rather unsettling thought about our current trajectory with modern technology and, you know, how we archive our lives.
Yeah.
We are living in a society that is deeply obsessed with hyper-resolution. We carry 4K and 8K cameras in our pocket that fiercely compete to capture every single blade of grass, every distant brick in a building, and every pore on a face with this chilling, robotic, objective perfection.
We want everything sharper, clearer.
Right. We have been conditioned by tech companies to believe that hoarding this flawless visual data is the exact same thing as having a better, more accurate memory.
If the photo captures the background perfectly, we just assume the memory is preserved perfectly.
Exactly. But the human brain simply does not store memories with that kind of mathematical, democratic equality. We do not remember the background of a beautiful day with the same sharpness as the face of the person we spent it with.
No, we definitely don't.
We filter absolutely everything through emotion. We naturally blur out the irrelevant details to protect the core feeling.
Which raises an incredibly provocative question about where our technology is heading. I mean, we are already seeing the introduction of AI tools that promise to perfectly reconstruct our pasts.
Oh, the unblur features.
Yes, features that automatically unblur faces, artificially generate missing background details, and aggressively sharpen every pixel of our old photos to make them look like they were taken yesterday.
And if technology eventually removes all the blur, all the faded edges, and gives us a mathematically perfect, objectively sharp recall of every single moment of our lives, we risk losing the human footprint entirely. Because memory actually requires forgetting. It requires the blur and the desaturation of the background to give meaning to the foreground. If our digital archives never allow the background to fade away naturally, we might eventually lose the emotional hierarchy that tells us what actually mattered in the first place.
The burden of a perfect digital memory might actually destroy our ability to feel the past. The next time you look at a perfectly sharp, technically flawless photo in your archive, ask yourself, what is the cost of never letting the background fade away?